Mesdames et messieurs, bonsoir et bienvenue à la Grande Bibliothèque. Je me présente, Pascale Ryan, chargée de projet à la direction de la programmation de Bibliothèque et Archives nationales du Québec. Bibliothèque et Archives nationales du Québec et l'Institut Thomas More sont heureux de présenter ce soir la quatrième d'une série d'entrevues intitulée « The Culture of Our Cities, Conversations on Today's Urban Experience », au cours desquelles des invités de marque partagent avec le public leur point de vue sur la complexité grandissante de nos villes en expansion. L'invitée de ce soir est Mme Julia Gerzovitz, architecte et professeure auxiliaire de design à l'Université McGill. Elle sera interviewée par MM. Andrew Byers et David Dussault de l'Institut Thomas More. L'entrevue de ce soir est enregistrée et vous pourrez la réentendre en balado-diffusion sur notre portail. Cette entrevue, qui se déroule en anglais, sera suivie d'une période de questions. Je tiens également à mentionner que cette soirée est photographiée. Nous nous excusons donc pour les inconvénients que cela pourrait causer en termes de bruit et de flash. Enfin, je vous prierai d'éteindre vos cellulaires. Sans plus tarder, je cède la parole à nos invités et je vous souhaite une bonne soirée.
Good evening, and thank you very much, Pascale. Pascale Ryan has been helping introduce our interview series here in this wonderful auditorium. We are very pleased, Thomas More Institute is very pleased to have been welcomed into the award-winning Grand Bibliothèque and to have received such warm hospitality and professional assistance. You can learn more about us at Thomas More from this year's prospectus, which is available at the exit, and you could become part of our mailing list for the new 07-08 schedules when they're published in July. Our reading discussion courses are created anew every year, so it's always exciting to see what's in the offing. This series of interviews is dedicated to the memory of Ben Scher, a longtime and much missed companion of Thomas More Institute. He was a strong example of one who, as our founder Eric O'Connor would say, made curiosity the center of his life. And now I'd like to introduce our panel. First, a sincere thank you to Julia Gerzovitz for being with us tonight. Her experience in the field of architecture and the historical preservation of buildings within cities make us anticipate with pleasure her thoughts on the culture of cities and the urban experience. Julia Gerzovitz is a partner with the architectural firm of Fournier Gerzovitz & Associés and a member of the Quebec Order of Architecture, the Ontario Association of Architects, the Canadian Association of Professional Heritage Consultants, and a fellow of the Royal Architectural Institute of Canada. She was educated at McGill and Columbia Universities. During the past 25 years, she's established an impressive reputation for her work with heritage buildings. Her commitment to excellence in conservation has touched her private practice, her teaching, and her design review commissions, leading to widespread recognition of her as an architect, an architectural historian, and a conservation expert. At present, she's the vice president of the newly formed Comité d'Architecture et Urbanisme for the Ville de Montréal and chairman of the Architecture and Planning Committee for Westmount, as well as being the Heritage Conservation Advisor for the Nathan Phillips Square Design Competition in Toronto. During her career, she's been a member of many consultative bodies in Montreal, Quebec, Ontario, and Ottawa, as well as Parks Canada. Like all of our guests for this series, she's an extremely busy and involved citizen who's made herself available for this project, and we feel very grateful and honored to have her here. Joining her in a dialogue tonight are Andrew Byers, here on my left. Andrew was raised and educated in Winnipeg, but he became a Montrealer in 1976 when he transferred from the London, England offices of the Reader's Digest to their Canadian headquarters here. As a book editor, he worked on some 60 titles of immense variety. Some of his outstanding Canadian titles were Canadians at War, The Atlas of Canada, and in 2004 he completed the new Canadian Atlas before his retirement. His editorial and journalistic skills have been much appreciated by students facing the daunting writing projects in our Bachelor of Arts program, and he's a patient and helpful guide. He's a member of the board of directors of Thomas More Institute and the chairman of the curriculum committee. Andrew initiated and maintains the Institute's partnership with the Musée des Beaux-Arts by designing courses that give added dimension to the experience of attending the museum's important exhibitions. His eclectic interests and wide knowledge contribute to the challenging and exciting courses he designs, and he has been designing since 1989. David Dusso, on my far left, had the intense and rewarding experience of joining us in his midlife as a candidate for the BA degree in liberal arts awarded through our affiliation with Bishop's University, a project he completed successfully in 2004. For the 25 years before that, he'd been a successful vice president and director of manufacturing, and since his degree, he has begun his own business, David Dusso Life Design. Thomas More Institute is pleased to have his experience and creativity as a member of various committees and as a course leader. These three illustrious persons will be conversing for about an hour, and then the floor will be open for questions to Madame Grisevich from you.
This is the fourth and final session here at the library. The first session, under this blanket title of The Culture of Cities, was by Julian Cher, and he talked about the dark side of cities. Sherry Simon talked about Montreal as a kind of literary patchwork, and Lise Bissonnette talked about the cultural dynamics of Montreal. Now we have Julia Gersowitz, who is a hands-on architect, and now we're going to be talking about the physical entities, the urban environment in which we live, and particularly Julia's experience in trying to preserve that which is really vital or important from our past. My first question is, why is conservation so important in your view?
Well, I imagine that there are many reasons that I could put forward. One of them certainly would be that it seems that we become increasingly unsettled when our immediate landscape changes very radically without our participating in that change. So that if you walk out and you know your neighborhood and then your neighborhood starts to change around you very radically because people are, without your desire and sort of necessarily without your knowledge, tearing buildings down, you begin to be unsettled. So there's an emotional attachment to the environment. That would be one of them, but we could kind of unroll a parchment and begin to talk about a lot of different reasons.
Yes, what are some of the kind of major threats to our physical urban environment? I certainly think probably there are natural and there are also man-made threats, are there not?
Well, you mean aside from the catastrophe of a fire, the majority of our threats are from development. Because for a very long time, certainly since the Second World War, the end of the Second World War, many people have defined progress by newness, and I think that that's the antithesis to the preservation of a city. The other thing, obviously, you know, according to many, would be the a resurgence or the complete power of the automobile. But we've sort of settled into not destroying things necessarily for highways anymore. That would have been a battle of some time ago. But we're still faced with the fact, I find it completely astonishing, that whenever you're faced with a series of building sites, of which five of the six are parking lots, and one has a historic building on it, that will be the one that is developed.
David.
Well, but it brings up the question that in looking at preservation, we are confronted with what we term progress. What are the criteria for deciding what is worthy of preservation, what has historical value, what because of its oldness, and what's just plain old?
Perhaps I can just interject here. Julia has very kindly provided us with some images, and the first image is actually from the Parliament buildings in Ottawa. Now, this is a case of a building that is seriously neglected. It's the East Block, I believe, is it not?
Well, it's either the East or the West, but
right.
They were both built at the same time by the same architect, so I'm not certain which gargoyle this belongs to. Let us just say that it's a Parliament building.
Okay, now let's continue on and look at this chart. These are the various levels of intervention when you evaluate a project. Perhaps you can just lead us through this.
Well, when David and Andrew and I first began to talk about this, because although it's an interview and it's by its nature, you will see it's certainly unrehearsed, there is at least some points of contact to discuss the most basic aspects of the interview. And it became very clear early on in the conversation that we were having trouble with terminology. And
that's right. We were talking about rehabilitation right. and reconstruction, and we really didn't right. know where we were
so,
at.
So Andrew and David said, if we're suffering under this level of confusion, maybe the audience will be as well. And so what I agreed was to present this slide that I use in teaching to help sort things out. And if you imagine that you're at ground zero here, and you have anything just to keep the ruin as it is, that would be called consolidation. Any intervention that will take you backwards in time will be things that are called things like words like restoration or reconstruction, and words that brings the building forward in time. Where you rehabilitate it, you insert new systems, you may change its use and renovate it. Those are words that bring the building forward. And as I was explaining, it is impossible. I don't think I've ever worked in the 25 or maybe 30 years of practice on a building that doesn't receive several interventions. So you may speak about we're restoring this building, but really you're probably mostly rehabilitating it, introducing new fire stairs and air conditioning and other things like that, and attempting to restore the exterior, and I would hope restore the interior mm-hmm. as well. So there be and perhaps reconstruct elements that are missing, so that any building will be subjected to a series of discrete interventions. Mm-hmm. Now, I hope that clarifies things and may muddy it up more, but we gave it a good shot.
Now, there are examples of intervention which are rather insensitively handled, and perhaps we can turn to...
This is an awkward thing to show because, in effect, I'm showing an example that you probably know, but it was a very early example. It remained, I understand, for the Presbyterian Church to be rather controversial. And it's supposed to be a generic explanation of taking a building and converting it into something that seems radically different from its original function, so that it's a church. In this case, it was a Presbyterian church, but it could be any denomination that ended its life as a condominium project. And I guess the question is there's an issue about appropriateness or fit, as we mm-hmm. call it in conservation, whether a building, whether the new use fits the old use.
It seems as though adaptive use, which is a term that I've heard a great deal,
right.
that schools are being turned into condo. I mean, it's condo madness now. There are so many businesses. For example, in New York, the Morgan Bank has been turned into a condo. It's an extraordinary change of use.
Well, is there a danger, though, of preserving the facade just for the sake of the facade? You know, there's got to be, for example, this Presbyterian church, there is obviously a functional end use to it. Mm. Is it appropriate? I don't know.
I think that, you know, you asked, to some extent, one of the questions was, how do you sort out what you should be doing? And some of the changes happened in conservation practice, if you want, in the last 30 years, is an attempt to try to make it more objective and less subjective, less intuitively looking at a building and saying, mm-hmm. yeah, that's a good building, or that's a building by an exceptional architect, or that has a great deal of historic resonance, or whatever the reasons might be, or it has marvelous craftsmanship, or it's an astonishingly early uh-huh. example of, or it is the last example of. Mm-hmm. But so that there's an attempt to try increasingly to be able to explain to people why this building and not that building. But one of the things that also becomes important in the theory of the project, I think, is what is important about that building. Now, the church is important because it's a very large space that is a significant cultural institution for the city. If you change that, taking it out of the public hand and into the private realm, you've already trespassed. If you take it out of the if you take the large, significant space that defines the interior of the church and you destroy it into cubicles, you've destroyed something. I mean, the same problem exists to some extent with factory buildings, which are industrial in there and have a certain heroism from their industrial scale, and you turn it into tiny little condos. Or you could argue that the bluntest example would be theaters, in which you say, good news, we've saved the exterior, but the interior, which is really what's important about a theater, has been turned into dental offices.
I wonder what that says about us, as though we have really no respect for the idea of a place with a specific designation. I mean, things can be transferred willy-nilly without much... Is that a particularly modern or contemporary view?
Is the idea of this radical change or the carelessness of
the
change
carelessness of it
a particularly modern idea? I'm not certain. I think that what happened in the late 20th century was that we went from just demolishing buildings with a great deal of carelessness into gradually and perhaps grudgingly keeping them. And so that you got a sort of period in which still I think exists today, so it's not that we're out of it, in which buildings were said, okay, we'll save it, but because people don't sit down and figure out what's important about the building, they don't realize what they should be saving. So you end up with a sort of Oscar Wilde, each man kills the thing he loves. You know, yeah.
So there's no particular... list of priorities. I mean, it would vary. There's context, there's significance.
Well, there's the appropriateness, which we discussed, but there's
fit.
Also context.
Yes.
And perhaps we can look at this image, which comes from New York, from Greenwich
Right.
Village.
This one I like to show a lot because it talks about... this is a row of federal townhouses, and in the United States, federal is what we call Georgian. So it's about just around the beginning of the 19th century. And in this case, there was a group of intact row houses, about six or seven in a row. And what made them significant really was the sense that they had survived 200 years almost intact, or about 168 years, because in 1968, these students from Columbia were making bombs in their parents' basement, or one of the kids was in his parents' house, and they were making bombs because they were members of the Weathermen, which was just about 1968, and they were going to, you know, change the world. In any event, they blew the house up, and I believe they were all killed. And what happened was that this became a very great cause célèbre for how to put back a building. What should they do? Should they just put back the building? Because obviously they had all the indications of what it looked like. They only had to look to the left, look to the right, and look down the street, and there was the rest of the building. Or should they mark the event? And there was a great deal of back and forth with the Landmark Commission. It went through several architects. It went through a lot of debate. And finally, they decided to do this kind of hybrid that you see on the screen, which is that the top matches, the bottom stoop matches, and then hell breaks loose in between. And they decided that that was incredibly important to mark the event of what had happened. Now, this is a problem in conservation because... you kind of need time to tell you, to sort out for you what is significant and what is not significant. 1969, 1970, they thought, this is a very significant event. But now, you know, when I lecture to my students and I say the Weathermen and I pause, nobody knows who they are. And so they were not a significant event in the history of the world. They were a blip on the radar, if that. And what they
didn't realize what was significant about those buildings was their intactness, not this isolated.
Well, there's stylistic intactness, yes.
Yes, the fact that they hadn't
represent a certain period, yes. Mm-hmm.
And so now you can't go by without saying, well, what happened there? But then when you find out what happened there, you say, well, you know, not who cares, but, geez, that doesn't seem to have been as significant as they first imagined it would be. So it's a sort of statement of failed significance.
So appropriateness, context, significance. Among your projects, which one are you most proud of?
Oh, the mother is never... I think that David and Andrew asked me this question, and I thought that one of the projects that you would know about probably is this one, which is the Harbor Commissioner's building. You see it obliquely in the upper left-hand side. Then you see it after the fire that happened to the building. And in the next slide, I think you see it as we restored, rehabilitated it, reconstructed it, and intervened on it. So in the next slide, I think you will see it. And this is a Harbor Commissioner's building that was made into a private club for the Daniel Langlois Foundation. And it was an extraordinary adventure, partially because there's new construction. You can just see peeking out behind the building the conservatory-like structure, which houses a swimming pool and health spa. There were all the kinds of interventions that a conservation architect dreams of doing with an exceedingly committed and engaged client.
If you look at the dome, it's not quite exactly the original dome, is it?
What's the material change to it is that in the picture that you see in the upper left-hand side, that's as it was before work began on it. Right. The picture that you see as it's finished is the same construction, same shape. We have more details because we reinstated things that had been removed with time. And the greatest change to it is that the original roof was in sheet metal, and Daniel Langlois really wanted it to be in copper. And we went into the archives at McGill, because part of the joy of being a conservation architect is you get to do a lot of research. And we found the original competition entry for the project, which was submitted by John W. Hopkins. And he showed the upper story of the building in sheet metal as you see it still today, and the dome in copper. And it was a hand-colored watercolor, so there was really no doubt about it. It was clearly green. And so we went to the Ministry of Cultural Affairs and said that both the client, the client would like to realize, if you want, the original architect's vision for the building, which was to have a great copper dome. And so we did it. But in fact, it's as near as it can be to reconstruct.
But you raise a great point here. You use the word the client was wanted it done. And in our conversations in your office, we had talked about the difference between, in your profession, for example, in my old profession, the customer was always right. But you made the distinction that the client is not always right. Do you want to elaborate on
that? Well, I think that that's the definition for anyone who is a professional in the field, is that you have to bring to your client a very informed understanding of the problem. And you may say to the client, I don't think you're right on this issue, and I presume be able to convince them with more than a tantrum about why they aren't. But you have an obligation to make certain that sometimes if he or she is not right in an assumption, that you can challenge that assumption. Mm-hmm.
Okay. When was this building put up?
1874. Or so. It had run into terrible cost overruns in the 1870s, and we think that's one of the reasons that the dome was put into sheet metal rather than copper. It was, and they also they had a lot of problems managing.
I find it very interesting that this belongs to Daniel Langlois Foundation. Now he's very much in the avant-garde in the art world. Why would he choose a Victorian building like this? This is really fascinating.
I think he's very very much involved in Montreal. And it's Montreal's heritage, and he long loved that building from afar. And so when he had the opportunity to buy it, I guess he bought it.
Well, that's marvelous. Yeah.
But
well,
he's very keen on Montreal's architecture.
Right. Is there something really special about Victorian architecture in Montreal? Something that we should keep our eyes open for? Is there something to... Well, there's the materials, for example.
Right. We had a very consistent palette in the 19th century until about the 1880s. Montreal was, by and large, made out of the same material that you see the foundation building being made out of, which is gray Montreal limestone, which was quarried in the mountain. If you're wondering why Mount Royal became a park, it was in part because people were looking up from this old city and seeing the mountain literally disappearing. So as it was being quarried, there was a quarry in Mile End. There were quarries in Pointe Claire. There was a small quarry in Westmount I know about. So it had a consistency of local materials. And then in the 1880s, because of changing tastes and changing rail connections across North America and foreign architects coming in, you got a lot more non-native stones coming into Montreal, and you get red buildings and beige buildings and gray and yellow sandstone buildings for Miramichi. And I'm wondering, actually, with sustainable design, and you know, you keep, right. Now everybody keeps talking about how you really shouldn't be bringing in products from far away. You should be bringing in eating local terroir products and eating and building with locally or relatively local products. Maybe we'll go back to the 19th century and end up all with local materials.
So these quarries are still potentially ready to be used.
Well, there are some quarries in the... I think if we got back into mining Mount Royal Park, somebody would know this.
Les Amis de la Montagne might have a thing or two to say about that.
I always understood that we ran out of that kind of stone and we started building in brick just before the First World War.
I don't think it was necessarily a loss. It's true that the quarries that I've just mentioned are all closed and the land has been built on. But in fact, architects who work with limestone, either for restoration work, either for conservation work or for new construction, there are quarries in the region that are a very close match to Montreal limestone. But I think that what you saw at the end of the 19th century was a change from stone into brick for cost reasons. It was primarily cost rather than taste
or
changing.
Depletion of resource. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. What are the other considerations when you're talking about conserving a building? We discussed the concepts of integrity and authenticity, certainly as related to art and also to architecture. Perhaps we can turn to this.
Well,
maybe if you could just explain this strange image.
Why am I showing you these French kings with without their noses? Well, in part, I believe that both you could argue the roots and some of the problems in conservation theory stem from the fact that we began by adopting theory from art conservation. Okay, so in art conservation, if you look at these kings, you would say they don't have their noses, but nobody in the field of art conservation would suggest that the museum pay to put their noses back on, right? You look at these objects, you look at a vase that has, you know, its form may be reconstructed, but where there are pieces missing, they will put in a white, fairly neutral piece to suggest the form. So we come with this idea that authenticity is hugely important. That's, of course, why we don't put the noses back on the kings, because you want the most important thing is the authenticity of the art object. In architectural conservation, you're really dealing with a building that must endure in the outside world. So under harsher climatic conditions than these kings nestled in their museum. And you have to deal with the fact that people move through these spaces and they use them in a way that they don't use an art object. And I think that to some extent what we deal with in conservation is a balancing act between authenticity of the object, if the object is a building, for example, and integrity of the building. And sometimes you may realize or suggest that it's more important to reinstate or reestablish the original finishes of a room, for example, rather than leave it in a deteriorated state as you might if it's an art conservation project.
So in this particular case, integrity takes on a slightly different connotation. More in terms of, because I guess you're always balancing actual function with the form.
Well, that's right. And if function implies an element of use, yes, absolutely. So that the complexity. I mean, I'm sure if I were sitting here with an art conservator, they would let go and really blast me. But I think that the problems are not as easily transposed as just taking the same theories and practice in art conservation and using them without adapting them to the specific problems of architectural conservation. Anyway, that's the theory, my theory.
I'd just like to talk a little bit about your personal background. How did you get into the field of architectural conservation? What drew you to it? What's the inside story?
Well, you have to start by how did I get into architecture? Because in the days that I became an architect in 75, graduating from McGill, there wasn't a separate particular discipline of architectural conservation. And everybody always talks about when they were five there. You know, they were given a Meccano set or something, or blocks, and realized they had to be an architect. It was my father, who's here tonight, that actually said to me that I should be an architect, and because I was very good in art and very good in sciences, so it seemed like, which is a sort of function, perhaps, of the fact that my father is an engineer and my mother is an artist. But in any event, genetics aside, I was seized by the feeling that when you destroyed a building, it was like you destroyed the last of a species. It was like as you watched a building go down, it was as if you were killing the last dodo.
Were you killing the lives of all the people who may have lived at that site?
Well, you were destroying something irreparably.
Yes.
And you had to be awfully, awfully certain that that was still a good idea as you allowed the wrecking ball to destroy it. And I can't explain it any more than that, which would be an emotional reaction to the situation to begin with, and I guess that would be it.
But it makes sense, because really the buildings that we know, that we grew up with, are part of our memory. They're part of our... We internalize particular sites, particular places, don't we?
Well, yeah, well, let's go back maybe then to the 60s. Growing up in the 60s with the way everything was being bulldozed and razed, did that have a profound effect on you?
I can't
or
say
a passing
that
notice, maybe not more than that?
I don't know that I could say to you that I looked at a building and it went. I think that you're quite right in saying that our memories are very much connected to the physical landscape around us, whether it's built or it's natural, and that, you know, as some people have said, that you can call things up by smell of something, a specific food, you can also call it up very much by walking the same streets that you walked as a child. That being said, I grew up at a period... I was at McGill in the 70s when, you know, the most shocking thing that happened was the destruction of the Van Horn mansion. Other than that, I think that we noted the destruction of the downtown as a kind of thing that went on a sort of relentless basis, but wasn't, I don't think, something that immediately said to me, I'm going to get involved in this. When I left school, I got involved in Save Montreal, and I'm retiring in a few weeks from the board of Heritage Montreal that I've been on for 20 years. But getting involved at a grassroots level, which seems, frankly, not to be done that much anymore, and I think to the detriment of the way in which the city is celebrated. I think that if people are passive about what happens, then things will happen that are not very good. But I can't say to you that it was a specific moment in my life.
And yet it seems that people did realize that cities were being... There was this clean sweep going on, and buildings were being turned. Lise Bissonnette made some reference to that last week. When I think of my own experience growing up as a kid in the late 40s, you know, there was a time when you never saw anything being built. It was really a period from the beginning of the Depression till the late 40s when nothing was built. And then suddenly there was a lot being built, and it was built in this international style. This was the triumph of modernism. Now, I guess modernism is, in a sense, a somewhat bankrupt movement. At least it seems to be considered by some.
Well, I think that we are actually in a new revival of modernism.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. But I think that, as with all revivals, there's this different spin. No revival ever is birthed without a change in something, change in technology, change in attitude, change in proportion, something. But we're now seeing modernism to some extent, I think, with a more of a sense of context than existed before. Mm-hmm. But equally, a lot of the new buildings that you see in the periodicals are modernist buildings devoid of any context. Mm-hmm. The chess pieces that you used to see being celebrated in, you know, the 1950s and 60s, where you'd see men standing, it was always men, and they'd be standing around a table staring at this model that would always be large and very, very tall.
Makes you wonder, doesn't it?
Well, I see. That was a conversation stopper.
Right. Yes. No, but for something completely different. Yes.
Right.
Well.
Well, is it hot in here? Is it just me?
Yes.
Well, I was going to ask you, is it postmodernism, which has introduced a kind of blending of styles, a kind of blurring of styles in the last 20 years? I mean, people, or are people just tired of the blandness of modernism?
Well, you know, postmodernism had some interesting aspects to it. Certainly there was an idea that they could go back to a vocabulary of the past and yet modernize it. But the problems, I think, by and large with it were, I'm not certain that there was an enormous buy-in by the powers that be for it. It was certainly a more costly thing, and yet at the same time, it was almost an illiterate thing. Sometimes I'd look at a building, as somebody who's had to study architectural history a lot in order to know what you're dealing with in conservation, and I'd go, you know, this must be what it's like at the end of the Dark Ages when somebody was sort of just barely beginning to write, and everybody was going, "My, that's marvelous! Look, you know." And the monks would be going, "What is? What are these people talking about? This is marvelous writing. The guy's written cat, you know." And the last time I looked at it, it was an illuminated manuscript. But now we're celebrating the word cat. So I think it ended up in a problem because it was, as I say, pretty illiterate in its proportions and in its understanding of vocabulary and its understanding of when you use a Palladian window as an exclamation point and not as your entire facade, you know. So it had a sort of bankrupt, it flamed quickly across the sky rather than being sustainable. But I'm sure there are many reasons as to why it wasn't sustainable.
There are a lot of environmental concerns now, and of course this may shape the way architecture goes. How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, I think that architectural conservation and environmental sustainability have a lot of points of conjuncture. There's no doubt about that. They don't seem to have yet made their marriages as much as they could. I was thinking about the fact that, you know, we keep talking about the redundancy of our churches. Mm-hmm. And yet, I just saw a new church being built in NDG. And I was thinking to myself, you know, what we need really is a sort of Craigslist for buildings. You know, somebody would put on the Craigslist this free circulation. I have a church that I don't need. And somebody else would say, oh, we're a parish and we need a church. And instead of, so I think until we get to the, one of the problems that I think that's happening with sustainability is it's very easy to say my building's sustainable because I've got these leads points, blah, 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 blah. But fundamentally, the project is a waste of resources because there's a building very nearby that's now redundant or vacant. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me odd to be celebrating that the project itself may be leads when you're spending a great deal of energy to build something and yet at the same time you're making another building really nearby redundant. And that seems sort of ill-matched. However, I'm not against new construction. I just think it would be a good idea if we tidied our houses up, if you want, in a way, before we started always looking at the new to solve the problems of whatever present situation we have.
But the problem here, at least it seems to me, is or not the problem, but the situation is that all of these decisions are made at levels that the public who live in these neighborhoods are really kind of the last people that are consulted. How do we incorporate a public role in this?
Well, I think that different municipalities have over time tried it. You know, Montreal has had a history of very autocratic decision-making powers that we remember perhaps from our childhood. Then it went into a lot more public consultations due to some extent because of the, I guess the you know, the Milton Park, for example, that Phil Slambert was very involved in making sure didn't go ahead, was a demonstration of public agitating against something. And I think that every municipal government has made its decision after the 1970s as to whether or not they will be more public consultations or less public consultations. Okay. So I don't think it's a stable thing. I think it changes from administration to administration. And we certainly have a lot of commissions right now that review things. And depending on how decisional they are, that will help determine whether or not what they speak of is listened to or not listened to.
Now, how do we marry the future with some kind of a plan, some kind of a vision, if you will? I mean, I look at the city of Montreal, and you look at how it's all spread out, and the further it goes to the extremities, the more divorced it becomes from the core, if you know what I'm saying. And so, how do we make a, or is it necessary to make a homogenized attempt, or not so much a homogenized attempt, but an attempt to bring some kind of order, some kind of a theme, a vision in creating a better urban landscape?
Well, actually, I'm not certain that if I were to respond to the question by saying, does a city have to have a certain appearance or do the neighborhoods have to? I think that one of the things that we really have come in the last 30 years, I suppose, to really not only accept but celebrate is the enormous diversity of the neighborhoods of Montreal. The fact that, you know, if you said 30 years ago, I'm going to live in the plateau and I'm going to really be excited about it, people would be somewhat puzzled about it because it doesn't necessarily have an enormously standard, how shall I say, haute gamme architecture, okay? But I think that nowadays we have the ability to understand old Montreal, to understand the plateau, to understand the remnants of downtown, the area around McGill, and you can go on and on and on. And I think that that's a very positive thing, that people feel an ownership of their neighborhoods. And in feeling an ownership of your neighborhoods, of your specific neighborhood, you can really begin to feel that you will not accept change to it willy-nilly. Okay. Does that make
sense? That makes perfect sense. It seems almost as though we want to go back to the 19th century ideal of what a city was. I mean, it's only within 150 years or so that cities have become really livable with sewage systems, street lighting, transportation systems. Somehow that idea disappeared after the war. It became passé. And now there's a sense that perhaps we're returning. Are we returning to a vision, a more stable vision of what a city should be?
I think, well, you know, nostalgia, as we all know, is a dangerous chemical because we can, you know, we think about the 19th century devoid of cars, and that must have been lovely, but it wasn't so lovely because it was filled with horses and you know, excrement and poor sewage. And St. Henry, for example, had, by the end of the 19th century, a child death rate greater than Calcutta at the time.
Gosh.
So one has to be careful to imagine what we are wishing for. In the same way that whenever I take my students to a house that's a significant house, I know, I say, we all imagine ourselves to be the gentry coming to the house. Nobody imagines themselves to be the servants. Right?
So there's this ideal world, and we can share in it, but it's not the real world that existed at that time.
Well, it's a very sanitized understanding of it. And again, we're viewing it as if we are all gentry within that world rather than being the skivvy or the, you know, the scullery maid or something even less and more down the eating chain. Somebody used the word urchin the other day in a conversation. I thought, Christ, there's a job description that's gone. Yeah, like nobody is an urchin anymore, but in the 19th century, there were urchins. And I guess the thing that is intriguing is if we can achieve a balance which, to some extent, sustainability is demanding of us, that we move from this extremely spoiled child that emerged out of the end of the 19th century or maybe emerged after the two world wars and came and took over and said, you know, that I'm terribly entitled and I want this and I want this and this. And we are pushed by the principles of sustainability and the terror about what's going to happen if we don't behave into a more balanced life that mitigates between the car and the city pedestrian. Perhaps then we achieve the utopia that we're hoping for.
Utopia.
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 Yeah.
And while we're on the subject of utopia,
yes, indeed,
you very kindly pointed this out to us. One of the early forebears or forerunners of the conservation movement could be Thomas More. Would you be kind enough to read that?
I'll read this. It is from Thomas More's seminal work, Utopia, written either in 1515 or 1516, variously. And I guess Utopia is like any sacred text. Anybody who opens it can read exactly the passage that they want that means something to them. That's brilliant about it. Anyway, this is what he wrote. He said, "It frequently happens that the same house which one person built at a vast expense is neglected by another, who thinks he has a more delicate sense of the beauties of architecture, and he, suffering it to fall to ruin, builds another at no less charge. But among the utopians, all things are so regulated that men very seldom build upon a new piece of ground and are not only very quick in repairing their houses, but show their foresight in preventing their decay so that their buildings are preserved very long but with very little labor." Yeah, so he turns out to be extremely prescient.
Yes, I would say so.
Yes, who knew?
Who knew?
What are your hopes for the future in terms of architecture, in terms of conservation?
I think that obviously I'm hopeful for a city that builds, that renews, but builds and renews without demolishing at the same time, where the act of demolition will involve buildings that can be seen to be demolished rather than buildings that have value in their demolition. I think it would be lovely if we had a society that was built as Thomas More identified, where you kept your nest in good shape and moved on from there, rather than constantly, as we seem to be saying, people speak about us befouling the planet nest. We're, so perhaps that would be the best if we were all shipshape and tidy and kept going from there. I think we'd probably be happier on the whole.
It's kind of paradoxical when you think of it. Most Western cities, Montreal, now seem very old. When there was an article in the New York Times talking about the skyscrapers that are being built all over Asia and Seoul and Malaysia and so on and so forth. There's a kind of competition going on. These cities are very new, but they don't seem to be cities that have any coherence, and they seem to be very spectacular.
Right.
Whereas we seem to be turning our back on that kind of philosophy and looking more inward and looking at our resources.
But that is, I think, a function of a coming of age. Mm. And also, you know, it used to be, and maybe it still is, that we would say that what mistake the United States made, we would make faithfully 20 years later. If they had urban renewal in the 50s, we had it in the late 60s, 70s. And I think that what's happening, that you see that, you know, just as in every condition, we turn against and become fanatical about not allowing smoking, but in the same environments that you're speaking of, these excessive kind of building and hire and demolishing as much as possible of the context as they do it, you know, they're equally smoking like chimneys. So I guess that it comes as a package of some delay time. It would be fascinating to meet those people who didn't follow that path but were able to say, we're not going there. We can already see that it's not working in this way. We'll take what's good about it that we understand, but we're not going full throttle to the whole package. But I don't seem to find that we see that society.
No.
But one of the things that I must say that I'm particularly seized by with Thomas More's quotation is his understanding of the fact that, you know, that somebody will build something, cherish it, consider it to have value, and the next person, as he says, who thinks he has a more delicate sense of the beauties of architecture, will destroy it. And so it must be part of the human condition, because it's now, over 500 years old, that quotation, and yet it's a living quotation.
I suppose in the past there was much more adding on to existing buildings. If you look at the great cathedrals, for example, they weren't built overnight. They took a long, long time to accumulate their structure and so on. So perhaps at that time there was quite a different view of what a building should be and what it should stand for and how it should develop. There was no rush to build just for the sake of building. Perhaps there certainly weren't the demographic pressures to house people and so on and so forth.
I don't know. I think that the cathedrals, you could argue castles are like cathedrals in that they would be built over time as well, that they didn't have sort of finished buildings, although I think some of the great houses would be finished. They would then be added on to over time, but they did have certain projects that began and ended and they had a fixed vision of what that house would be, or project would be. But I think that that idea is increasingly a modern idea that really you see in the 17th and 18th and then to present day, the idea that this is your project, you're going to design it and you're going to build it, as opposed to a vernacular kind of medieval sense of adding on and adding on and accretion after accretion, which can give you a pretty rich jumble of experience.
Well, then how will cultural shift affect the future of cities? As we incorporate more and more cultures, it's not going to be a seamless integration. It's going to be a significant shift in population based on culture, which will in turn, I believe, probably affect the way in which our cities look, the way in which they're planned.
And the way in which people believe or not believe in conservation. Mm-hmm. I think that philosophically or culturally it does vary from population to population, just as, for example, certain religious denominations either have a very clear and close relationship to their built environment, and others will believe that when the sacred objects are taken out of them, they're disposable, mm-hmm. they can become something else. So that some congregations will say, if this is not going to be our house of worship, it must be demolished. Mm-hmm. Others will say, once we remove what makes it our house of worship, it can become anything else because it's only an empty shell at mm-hmm. that point. Mm-hmm. So if you can understand that as being a cultural extremes mm-hmm. and government having to work within those cultural extremes, you will see that there is going to be tensions involved in that. That would be an inevitability. I don't know what will happen.
In any urban environment, there are certain fundamentals that are common to all. Perhaps we can elaborate on that. Order would certainly be one of them, would it not?
Order or chaos? What you mean, broad philosophical?
Broad, yes, yes.
I'm not certain that I would be able to necessarily. You mean between a sense of order and a sense of
chaos.
I think that, frankly, the drive towards order is an absolutely 20th century idea. There's a desire for a rationalist approach to things. Whereas in earlier times, because they were unable to master it, there was chaos, whether or not it was planned or it was an inevitability of pushing a great quantity of people into a relatively small space and expecting them to function together.
Mm-hmm. Would comfort, shelter, these would be obvious ideals, I think.
They're obvious, but the question is the idea that they would be universal rights is, I think, a more modern idea than it has been in the past. It used to be something that would be sorted out by your income level rather than by the mere fact as being a human being, you were entitled to that or entitled to the benefits of libraries and other cultural institutions.
What about pleasure?
Government sanctioned pleasures, you mean?
No, I'm thinking more.
Oh, here we go again.
The pleasures of architecture. For example, the other day I was walking down Jean Mons and I was really astounded by just the stretch of Victorian buildings, and it gave me such a wonderful sense, not only of the past, and the sense of the people who had lived there perhaps at one time, but the fact that it survived and that it was going to continue on into the future, and that it was something very beautiful.
But that's one of the reasons we conserve buildings,
right,
to allow that zing of pleasure to continue from one generation to another generation. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's that ability to transmit not only your stories but your environment to the next generation mm-hmm. that's a rather compelling thing. I mean, the whole, it seems to be a primal force for us mm-hmm. to wish to pass on to the next generation at least the best things that we remember of our own generation.
It seems to me, though, that at this point in time, the one of the greatest challenges we have in our urban environments is the decaying infrastructure. How are we going to have we boxed ourselves out, do you think, to be able to actually make the infrastructure work again the way in which cities have taken form?
No, I think that you will see them renewed. I think that first of all, there are issues about conservation in most of these infrastructure projects, because infrastructure will deal with water delivery, it will deal with the removal of waste such as sewage, it will deal with how you move across water, i.e. bridges mm-hmm. and all sorts of things
internal
like that. Many of the structures that are involved in this or helped carry or serve the infrastructure will have perhaps some heritage value to it, because it's not only architecture that has heritage value, obviously, but it's also engineering feats or anything like that. So covered bridges would be an early example of an infrastructure project that now everybody pretty well says, oh, a covered bridge, I'd like to go see that. It must be a historic monument. Okay, so there's an early example of celebrating the infrastructure. But, you know, there are many engineering feats of other bridges that people have come to realize. I think that the thing that's interesting about, and many of you have no doubt done what I do, which is stop when you see a construction hole in the street and look down after layer of previous paving ideas that the city had, and marvel at that vast underground network. But and there's a lot of very interesting engineering feats attached to the infrastructure, such as the brick sewers, you know. But I think that one of the things that I find interesting is how our perception of what people did originally may change, and I wonder what will happen then. For example, in Old Montreal, there are a number of rivers that have been put into sewers, not because they're used to carry away wastewater, but because they're... it was seen, in order to benefit the city, they needed to be submerged and made, or tamed, if you want. And it would be interesting to see that as these infrastructure works go forward, are they going to wish to carry forward the same conditions, or are they going to say, let's liberate the Saint-Pierre River, or let's liberate the Ruisseau Saint-Martin, or whatever it is, so that it may be that there's a more modern... layering of understanding onto these projects, or it may be that the projects are brought forward in the strictest sense. It goes to the, what shall we say, the creativity of the people in charge of these kinds of projects.
Finally, I'd like to ask a question. It's your choice. What are your favorite sites in Montreal? What are the ones that are, give you the greatest pleasure?
You mean just in Montreal?
In Montreal, yes.
Things that I really enjoy.
That sort of reflect not only the past, but have been perhaps nicely integrated into the present.
Well, I think that the McGill campus is certainly something that gives me an enormous pleasure. And also the flanks of the Square Mile, which I did my thesis on, partially because they're still there, and you can still almost feel what it was like to be there. You can wander about in that environment and feel very much surrounded by buildings that you know intimately well and you admire tremendously, and where there's a great diversity, because it isn't really just, you know, being surrounded by buildings of the 19th century, but buildings that are compatible and work well together. And I think that that's certainly an area. I like many of us, enjoy walking in Old Montreal, but I have long felt a certain tension about Old Montreal, because I felt for a good amount of time there was a tendency for everybody to say, okay, well, we have Old Montreal and it's a historic district, therefore we can do whatever the hell we want with the rest of the city, okay? And in fact, that's how you kind of got the wholesale destruction of the downtown. Right. We have this precious little gem, therefore we can... So that there was a kind of mixed sense of both enjoyment of Old Montreal and a kind of annoyance that it was being protected and everything else was being destroyed. But you see, that's what I mean by this changing sensibility, where people will now say, we have Old Montreal, but we also have the Plateau, but we also have Petit Patrie, but we also have... So that there's more of a sense of not saying we just have this, therefore let's destroy everything else, but saying we have this, and we have this, and we have this.
And it's very special.
And I think that that's how we are celebrating the whole of the city, and that is a wonderful aspect of it. And that's a relatively new, I think, phenomenon, that people are able to be very excited about buildings which are, you know, fairly background fabric of the city buildings.
Right. Well, that's a very hopeful sign. Okay, well, now I'd like to turn you over to the audience for a question and answer period.
Well, thank you. Thank all three of you for
the many zings of pleasure that you gave us. I know the audience, who are Montrealers all, will probably have some questions, and there are microphones. If you'll put up your hand, someone will bring you a microphone.
Hello. Hello. I'm not sure if this is your, well, bailiwick, but I see down the road from where I live this new hospital that is going to come up. And it's going to have a tremendous effect on everything. And I'm just wondering, do you know anything about the architecture of the new hospital?
Well, I don't know which one you're referring to. We have two super hospitals that are being built, as they say. I'm sorry? The English one. Well, I've reviewed both projects, and they're not at a very advanced stage yet in terms of their architecture. And I think that with the McGill Hospital, there's been a gradual reduction in the square footage as they've decided to not move everything to the main site in NDG, but to use the Montreal General as a large part of the hospital complex. So it's been reduced in its volume and reduced in its, I suppose, to some extent, its impact. So there's not, I couldn't really comment on the conceptual designs that they use to bring the project forward. They've, I think, recently hired a new team of architects, or the team of architects, and they're going to be going towards much more detailed and elaborated designs.
And
Well, I think that that's a subject of some debate right now. I don't think that there's a belief that the VIC, which is the most historic, I think, of the McGill hospitals, would be demolished. I think that the fact that it is so near McGill is of interest to contemplate its reuse. I don't think that there's a sense that those buildings would be demolished, but there's not been a consensus or a decision, to my understanding, about how much of each building would be kept. The general, as I say, is going to be integrated into the new hospital as a satellite to the new campus out at in NDG. NDG / Westmount.
Yes.
I wonder if I have had a question for years that goes back to why so many schools in the 70s were built without windows, beginning with the Faculty of Education at McGill, which I think was born in 1971.
Right.
I wonder if you have an explanation.
Well, it was a ghastly social experiment in which they felt that you could reduce daydreaming, to my understanding, by removing the opportunities to look out the window. It was solely that. I mean, it was just startling in its social engineering, but that's the idea, and they practice it on small children and on the teachers who were going to be teaching them, because the Faculty of Education building was built to house the relocated McDonald College Teachers College, right?
Right.
So there you get it. The teachers got it both in their training and then in their field work. But that's my understanding of it. They felt, somebody felt that it would be brilliant. You could really focus people on their work if you eliminated those pesky views. Yeah.
Is it ever justifiable to demolish a portion of a neighborhood or a neighborhood? I know one of our former mayors in the city was highly criticized for wiping out one of the original little Irish communities called Goose Village.
Right.
down between Mill Street and Victoria and Riverside and Bridge Street, right near the bridge. It was originally an Irish community, and then it developed into an immigrant community, basically because of Canada Packers and the loading of lake boats and coal, etc. But was that justifiable to eliminate that because of Expo 67? Or should efforts have been made to do something about that particular neighborhood?
It's a very, to say, is it ever justifiable? It's a very difficult thing to be able to justify. I mean, it wasn't just Goose Village that was destroyed. You could look at large parts of St. Henry, where urban renewal was the expression, and the idea was that these houses were substandard, and therefore, in order to bring people creature comforts at a reduced cost, you would demolish them and house them in Little Burgundy. You would house them in the Jeanne Mance projects. I've referred to this before as an idea of utopia, of trying to bring forward the 20th century utopians, actually, or those who look towards utopia, saw very little value in these uncontrolled, chaotic cities of the 19th century and earlier, and so that they wished to demolish them and regularize them. And in Goose Village, unfortunately, it really ended up under a highway. But in St. Henry and in Jeanne Mance project, which is really just around the corner from this building, it was really to take away this messiness and put up something that was highly ordered and, to some extent, you could argue, much more controllable. Is it justifiable? It's a pretty hard thing in this time to say yes. I can't say that. You mean the greater good allowed them to say that the Bonaventure Expressway was necessary and therefore you could demolish their homes? You should watch Regine Padovani by Denis Arcand, one of his early movies in the early 70s, I think, and see what you think after you've watched that movie.
There are adjacent neighborhoods. Like, there's a whole section of the point between Old Montreal and the Old Point, Victoria Town, where the neighborhood has been maintained, but has basically become a very underrated slum neighborhood. Hardly anyone lives in the area. Many of the houses are just boarded up. From a municipal perspective, the approach be just to keep ignoring it the way it's being ignored now? Should developers be blocked from going into that area? What's the thinking that's out there about this type of situation? I'm thinking of Ann Street, Queen Street, King Street, and the old Victoria Town portion that's between Old Montreal and where St. Anne's Church used to be, between Peel, McGill, that whole area down in the lower part of town.
Well, curiously enough, to some extent, I think that the recent plans that have been spoken about in the press of the demolition of the Bonaventure Expressway would go well towards reknitting those neighborhoods which have become isolated back into the fabric of the city. I mean, isolation of a neighborhood by surrounding it by highways and other inhospitable barriers is really, you know, one of the easiest ways to then marginalize the area, create, as you will, a loss of population and a high vacancy, and then, you know, the area begins to be ripe for something else. But if they do go ahead with this project, which may or may not go ahead, and they are able to remove the Bonaventure, which was the reason for the destruction of Goose Village, perhaps they will be able to revitalize these areas, which still have a great quantity of the original housing stock and street fabric to them. I can't answer much more to it than that, but, you know, it's curious that the Bonaventure might be, its removal might be cause for celebration in those areas.
Okay, I have a question. I've just come back from Prague and Amsterdam, mainly because of the architecture, so I certainly appreciate restored old buildings. But there is somewhat of a movement to keep industrial infrastructure I'm thinking of the redoing of the Redpath refinery and maybe the additions of the rather ugly, to my view, apartments on the facade of the new museum, the Beaux-Arts. And do you think the industrial, some of the industrial stuff is worth conserving as well as the buildings of obvious beauty like it's being shown behind you?
Are industrial buildings worth saving?
Well, are some of them worth saving for historic reasons?
Sure. You could argue that the Redpath building was the first great industrial project in Canada, so it has some historic value. Whether or not it remains once you've change into condos is moot, but you could still argue that it represents a site of that. The problems attached to industrial buildings, and here I am not speaking of any specific project, I'm just saying in general, one of the problems with industrial buildings is that they weren't terribly necessarily well built to begin with. They were built as industrial factory buildings, and they may, you know, in the 19th century, there were different classes of brick, for example, and they often were made out of substandard brick, not the best brick which would go into somebody's house. They would be a second or third run brick. So that you're dealing with buildings where sometimes the owners don't realize that the very thing that they bought into is going to require an enormous amount of maintenance because of the absolutely inherent nature of the building. Namely, it's an industrial building and it's not built as well as companion buildings of the same age. And one should note, and I can say this with some degree of certainty and a lot of empirical field research, that buildings in the 19th century that survive into the 20th century or 21st century do so because they were extremely well built.
Hi, I have two questions. First question is quick. You showed us a church that had been turned into a condo.
And you live there. No, I hope
No. I was wondering, where is that?
I'm sorry?
Where is it?
It's in the student ghetto near McGill.
Oh, okay. The second question is, I live in Shaughnessy Village, and I got wind of a plan. You know the Mother House on St. Matthew and behind the Faubourg?
Mm-hmm.
That Concordia would like to build a modern extension to the Mother House when they take it over on the green space area on St. Matthew and behind the Faubourg. And I was wondering, what do you think of that? Do you think it would ever happen, and do you think it's a good idea?
I honestly have no idea what the project's about. The Grey Nuns is a very... you were asking me which buildings I like to walk by. The Grey Nuns was one of the buildings when I started when I was involved in Save Montreal in the early... in 75, 76 and onward. It was one of my dossiers to work on saving that building because there was a plan afoot to demolish it and put up high-rise buildings. And it was a serious project, and it was stopped in part because of groups like Save Montreal. And so I've always walked by that building and enjoyed it for very personal reasons, but I really don't know what the project would be, or I don't think I could comment on it.
Thanks.
I'm sorry, but I don't know it, and I don't think it's in the public eye at all.
First, I thank you. This has been wonderful. I've been a resident here for 30 years, and it's only the last few years in my retirement that I've come to admire and know the little sculptural details, such as you have on the screen now. But I would like to comment on this, the gentleman at the right, I'm sorry, I don't know your name, about the diversity of cultures coming into Montreal and how we will adapt architecture to their personalities or cultures. I really question whether there will be any adjustment or accommodation. I'm thinking of the Van Horn Mansion that was demolished, and many people wanted to save it, as I'm sure you know. It's now a hotel, So the person or the people who determine the architecture, they have the power and the money to demolish and to build what they want. I just wondered if you agree with that.
Well, I think that the Van Horn Mansion remains in our memory largely because it sparked the conservation movement in Montreal. And I think that so that you can look at it as a terrible thing at the time, it was certainly a very fine building built by a very interesting architect for a very significant Canadian. I mean, if you want to line up all your ducks as to why this building should have been saved, it would have been the Van Horn Mansion. I think that what it launched through its death, if you want, and there I do speak about this anthropomorphizing of buildings, is that I don't think it could be done that easily and that crudely today. And I think that there would be far more of a public outcry for to prevent that sort of thing. And all construct, you know, another aspect about art, although you could argue that all art, much art has patrons, and patrons have desires, much like clients in construction have desires, is that it does take money and it does take power to build. And so you always have a tension and between your desire to perhaps save something and somebody else's desires. Thomas More identified to demolish it for something that the developer certainly would see in that case as having more beauty of architecture, or perhaps also a greater return on the investment. But I think that there's much more of an age of consensus now and a much greater awakening. I mean, your question about the Grey Nuns indicates that too, that there's an anxiety in the population that they do not wish these things to be carried forth. And I think that, not to say go home and rest on your laurels, if I could say anything, it's go home and perhaps join Heritage Montreal. I don't think that such a bold and flagrant example of destruction of heritage would be done today in such an easy manner.
Hi. I have a specific question.
I'm having trouble seeing who's speaking, yes, which I must say is disconcerting.
Hi.
Okay, thank you.
I don't want to assume that you know every inch of Montreal, but I have someone mentioned they walk by a certain building and are curious, and this has raised my curiosity every time I go past, which is in the plateau. There's a very large glass building that's now used by university and art groups called, I think it's Télé-Québec. It's between Hôtel de Ville and Henri Julien and Villeneuve and Mount Royal, I believe. It's a very large monstrosity of a building that sort of looked like it was just dropped from the sky into a middle of a neighborhood that has duplexes all around it. And I was just curious to know if there is a history to, was there a fight that went up around that building? What the history was of that building, if you have any idea, or if anyone else in the room knows.
This is a good example of why we architects never give talks without slides or images. I can't think of this building, so I can't answer that, but perhaps if you email me a picture of it, I can email you something back. I can't think of it at all.
Can you go to the Milk Run restaurant?
It's very close
to the Milk Run restaurant. No. Barry had a question.
Yeah, he's got it.
Do you have any recommendations for the Catholic Church as to how to use their buildings now that the population of the congregations are decreasing so substantially?
Well, I think that, is it Cardinal Turcot who just said that he wants to involve the public much more in the decision-making? I think that's an admirable breath of fresh air into the debate. Because when you speak about the Catholic Church and the holdings of the church, it's not only the churches, it's actually the convent buildings, the
monasteries, sometimes the schools. It's a vast quantity of very important buildings. And if you speak about kind of a definition of a Quebec environment, or, you know, coming into Quebec Village that are captured in these paintings from the 20s and the 30s of Clarence Gagnon's villages, they're always defined by the church, the presbytery, and often a convent building that makes up the noyau central, the center portion of that village. They're incredibly important in our collective memory, whether we're Catholic or we're not Catholic, of, you know, just as we see the landscape as Le Mieux paintings in the winter, we see these buildings as being absolutely of critical importance to our collective memory. It's a very difficult thing to say what should be done with them, but certainly the idea that they could remain as public buildings, as buildings therefore enjoyed by the public, whether or not they are still worshippers or they are library goers or they are concert hearers or whatever they are, that seems to be a compelling aspect of it, rather than, you know, the church on Milton, it's in the Milton Park area that I showed you, is only one of several churches that I could show you, and one just finished, was just completed about last year, where they took a large Roman Catholic church and converted it into condos. So it's not a phenomenon from an old slide that's gone somewhat faded with the light that's 25 years old now. It's a current problem. But I do think that the Cardinal's latest statements are certainly very positive ones, because those buildings are really defining elements of our collective landscape. But it is a huge problem.
Is there any building in the city that you would consider an architectural disaster, or that you personally find distasteful?
I couldn't possibly allow myself to
say
discretion being the better part of valor. I say nothing.
Well, just one other question. Sure. Why was the Van Horn Mansion torn down? Why wasn't it stopped? If it was so significant, was it money? Was it essentially?
There were a lot of different factors, and some have to do with political power. Some of it, there are vast quantity of reasons. Well, vast quantity, they're not vast quantity. There are several reasons, most of which have to do with the fact that perhaps it wasn't as clear to many people as it has become that these buildings have value, that they define your streets, that they're benchmarks, that all of the stuff that we hold, some of us hold dear, because there will be others who see beauties of architecture in other ways. But there, you know, there have been articles written on that as to why and who said what to who and who had the way of, but there were no protections. That's basically the thing. It doesn't matter who had the site and who wanted to demolish it and who said this building is disposable like Kleenex. The point is that there was no mechanisms in place to say no, or very few mechanisms in place. And so even when there was a public outcry, by then it was too late. The permissions had been granted and the demolition ball was in place.
We have time for two more questions. In the middle.
Thank you very much for your comments. There is a movement to save Ben's smoked meat delicatessen building. And I just wonder, what's your opinion of that?
Well, that's an interesting question, because, again, you have to go back to
what I said perhaps at the beginning, which is why does something have value? Where is the value in the building? Is it in the interior? Is it in the atmosphere? Was it in the food? What I remember as being, you know, an experience of really, really rude waiters. I must say to you that I don't think it was the best smoked meat in town, but that's a debate for another place. Is it all of that and nothing about the building? Is the building in your mix as well as being an art modern building? I mean, those are the sort of issues that you would begin to analyze the problem about Ben's and then say, okay, is it? And if it is the food and the ambience and not have to do with the building and the decor, then it may be something that are intangibles and therefore cannot really relate to the building if it turns out to become something else. It'll be empty. It'll be a bit like saving the forum seats, but destroying the forum. Do you know what I mean? Because the idea about the forum wasn't that you sat in that chair. It was that you were there watching the great games of Les Canadiens hockey in that place, and that was what was significant about it. So the chair really has no value. So I guess you have to go through the process of sorting out what it is that makes Ben's a remembrance of things past for you and see whether or not they're sustainable. I don't mean in the new current jargon of it, but whether or not they can be continued to be in that building or whether or not they're gone like the crumbs of the sandwiches. I don't know. But I would suggest to you that those are that you owe it to the intellectual exercise to go through that kind of list of intertwined things that makes the place significant in your memory. It was one more.
Vincent, you have the last question?
A quick question. I would like to take you to Park Avenue because it raised a big issue of a name associated to an area or a neighborhood, and I think you mentioned neighborhoods as something being quite important. How well has Park Avenue and Saint-Laurent been revived and brought back to life? How well has it been restored?
Park Avenue?
And Saint-Laurent, because it used to be decrepit and is now back to life.
Well, you know, there's a way in which neighborhoods can revive that have nothing to do with architects. And that's an astonishing thing for an architect to say, right? But it has to do with a kind of messy vitality that moves in because, you know, the rents are low or there's a sort of buzz that builds and builds and builds. One of the things that we completed recently, my partner Roseanne Moss is in the audience, is a study on how to keep Queen Street West in Toronto, Queen Street West in Toronto, and the guidelines for preserving that area. But it's an area like Park and like Saint-Laurent, which is not favored necessarily by spectacular buildings, but is really the kind of wonderful, messy vitality, great restaurants, sort of funny, quirky businesses, all the sort of stuff that you find in those area, those two streets in Montreal, but where it's very difficult to legislate that, because how do you legislate the continuance of chaos when it's not been introduced by people in a controlled, systematic way? It just has happened. So that's difficult to do. I wasn't even aware that Park Avenue had undergone a renaissance. To me, it's the same street that it ever was, with everything that was, you know, very interesting about Park Avenue. Same thing with Mount Royal Avenue, which has, in fact, had a very definite merchants association that drove a certain vision of that street becoming revitalized and is now moving itself, I think, into a new sustainable idea that, you know, they're going to be bike-friendly and they're really going to cater to a young, hip, environmentally interested population. That's an interesting way, but you see, that kind of revitalization of a street comes not from the architects and not from the other professionals, but it comes from the grassroots up, it comes from the merchants, it comes from the people who live above the stores, and it comes from all of that. And that's an amazing resource that you can't create and you can't marshal and you can't pay for. If that's the last question, I just wanted to say how really thankful I am to my two interviewers who made this a fascinating experience for me, and to say to you that my mother was an interviewee by the Thomas More 20 years ago on American modern art, and so we have either started a tradition here or at least advanced something a little further. So thank you very much.
I wanted to thank you as well for being here tonight, but also for bringing your passion as a private architect and on the commissions you sit in and on your teaching, your passion for the city, to the city. You stayed in Montreal, and your involvement with Heritage Montreal, I think, has made the city... partially made the city that we love at the moment. So thank you for that as well. I wanted to tell you all that this is the fourth of five interviews about the urban experience and the last that we're going to have in this beautiful venue. On June the 12th at 7 o'clock in the building on Atwater, at Atwater and Sherbrooke, the Thomas More Institute building, we'll be holding our annual convocation, and as part of that, we'll be interviewing Linda Leith, who is a writer and the founder of Blue Metropolis, on her ideas of the culture of cities. So we hope we'll see you there, and thank you for coming tonight. Good night.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Wonderfully articulate.